The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
What we've developed is a system, and that system correlates to the name of Hashem. The crown of the Yud itself, the He, the Vav, and the He. Okay? And what correlates to them is the will, the goal, the plan, the principles of organization. Very nice. And then the activity itself. Okay? That's the system, a conceptualization of the structure of the process of reality. Doesn't that sound nice? Okay. So now we began to plug in basic Jewish concepts, which begin to come alive. The mitzvot and the halakha is the particular activity which coordinates to the process of life, to the plan, the theme, the goal. The Torah are the principles. Okay? The plan is to give of His goodness to other. The goal is to reveal His oneness. And so it be the will. That's it. Judaism in a nutshell. Okay? The theme of Judaism is love. The principles that direct a world towards the fulfillment of that is Torah, and the mitzvot enable us to coordinate our lives within that process to fulfill that theme and establish a connection between ourselves and the goal, the will. Okay, that's it. Everything else is commentary. Right? This is the complete system of how Judaism works. All right? Now, this is mirrored in our own consciousness. And that's what I'd like to deal with today, which is, according to Jewish mysticism, there are five levels of soul. Now, we'd explain that there seems to be six. But the sixth is what's called the animalistic soul. Okay? The animalistic soul is that basic force of life that animates life. Okay? It animates our brain, it animates our emotions. And animals have that, and human beings have it. It's a force of life, it's a certain physical consciousness. Okay? Consciousness of survival. But then there is what's called the divine soul. And the divine soul is considered to be five. Five divine souls. Or I think we could refer to it as five levels of divine soul. And we explained what's the difference between a divine soul and an animal soul. What does divine soul offer a human being? So when we learned Moda Ani Lefanecha, thanking I am before you, King who's alive and established because you gave me back my soul, that teaches us, right, that the soul enables us to, number one, enjoy a direct relationship with God without melting on the spot. And number two, to have consciousness of the various values which are indicative of that kind of relationship. All right. For instance, we had presented the scenario of a dog. A dog may look like they're making a decision. They're looking at you. They're looking at the white shag carpet. Right? And it looks like they are making a decision. But if you, you know, we can intuit, although you can't prove it, obviously, but I think we all intuit, that the process going on within the head of the dog, the dilemma of the dog is not, shall I piddle or shall I not piddle, right? The dog isn't really dealing with, well, is this meaningful? Is this right? Is this truthful? Is this idealistic? Is this what I'm living for? Is this what it's all about? But the dog is basically coming from a self-survival point of view, which is, you know, will I get kicked, you know, by my master or not? Will he notice it? Will I get thrown out of the house? Okay. The divine soul gives access to values, principles, considerations which are not within the physical realm. Okay? Not within the physical realm. So I'd like to now explore the five souls. However, I must tell you that even about in terms of the five souls that we are exploring, we're still only scratching the surface, and this is only one aspect of these souls, which is a much more psychological implication of these souls. All right? So first of all, you have what's called nefesh. It's the lower level soul. And nefesh is associated with good and bad. It's associated with the notion of justice. And justification. It's associated with a sense that my actions have real meaning. Now let's explore this a little bit. Let's say you have a fellow who's working in a car factory. And he's on an assembly belt. He's responsible for tightening this one screw. Right? Car comes in front, he goes, eh, ah. Car comes in front, That's his job. So if you were to speak to this fellow, say, wow, what a monotonous job, must be pretty boring, and must be really difficult to do a job like that. So, well, you know, it's a job, it's a living. Say, but how do you spend your day doing something meaningless? All day long. You think he's going to say, well, you know, it's meaningless, but I love to do meaningless things. He's going to say that. He's going to say, what are you talking about, meaningless? It's meaningful. You know, people need cars. You understand, if I don't tighten that screw just right, a person could, like, wipe out on the highway. I mean, what are you talking about? It's a meaningful job. Right? I'm doing something which is contributive. I'm doing something that has meaning. You follow? Or even if you were to find a fellow who says, well, you know, you're right, it's meaningless, but listen, I got to make a living. I got a family, got kids, got to send them to school. He'll still justify what he's doing. Nobody would ever do a job for an extensive period of time that is truly meaningless. Take a guy working in an airport, and his job is to move baggage from the table to the belt as it goes into the aircraft. Table to the belt. Table to the belt. That's all he does, 8 hours a day. So you say to the fellow, wow, I feel sorry for you. Yeah, what a monotonous job. It must be really meaningless. You think he's going to say, you're right, it's meaningless? He's like, it's not meaningless. What are you talking about? These people have to get places, they have jobs and vacations, and I'm helping people, and it's really important. If I, for some reason, make a mistake and drop one of the bags, and they don't get their, I mean, who knows what could be in that bag? Their medicine, you know? What are you talking about? It's meaningful. And even if you get a person who would say, you know what, you're right, it has no meaning. But I gotta make a living. Well, let me ask you something else. What if we gave you the same amount of money, but all you have to do all day long is pick up the shmata and put it over here. And pick it up again and put it over here. And pick it up and put put it over here. Pick it up and put it over here. Would you take the job? Well, what about if we doubled your salary? Double what you get moving this luggage from a table to conveyor belt. Would you take the job? Well, some people might say, yeah. But how long could they do that without actually going mad? It's an amazing thing. People need meaning in their lives. More than water, more than food. Without a sense of meaning in their lives, they could actually physically just die on the spot. Right? Now, how did you get such a sensitivity? How do you know there's a quality in life called meaning? Where'd you get it from? Social development, social conditioning. Is that where you got it from? Thousands and thousands of years, people have conditioned themselves to think meaning so important to the extent that they could physically break down if they don't have it. And where is this meaning anyways? Can you find it in a microscope? Can you write a mathematical equation? This is meaning? No. It's spiritual. It's not in the physical world. I mean, obviously you feel in this physical world, but it's not something tangible that you can hold on to and grasp. And yet we have this awareness of a quality of life that's available to us that's called meaning. Yeah, Peter?
But why does that necessarily make it spiritual? I mean, why can't it just be mental? I mean,
doesn't matter. I'm not interested in the word spiritual, not. The point I want to make is it's not tangible in terms of something you can hold on to. It's not as real as the water. It's not as real as the food. And yet it's even more real, even though you can't hold it. You can't grab it. You can't point to it. Okay? That's the point. That's
the only thing. The non-physical element to it is making it more real?
No, I'm saying the non-physical element of it is what's fascinating in terms of the fact that we're so aware of this. Why are we so aware of it? It's real, and yet it's not physical. And so what I'm simply trying to help people understand through their own consciousness is that you have an awareness of something which is not physical and which cannot be proven to exist. And yet, its existence is critical for life to go on. You follow? It's an amazing thing. When you really think of your own psychology, you realize woven into the fabric of my psyche is this awareness of something called meaningful actions. Okay? And of course, those meaningful actions are generally what gives me a sense that this is a good thing to do. This is good. And we all have an awareness of good and bad. What that good and what that bad is, well, that we might have a discussion about, maybe a dispute about. But that there is a good, we all seem to really believe there is. And not only that, but we feel and experience the need to be good. Right? Except for Michael Jackson, who doesn't mind being bad. Right? Everybody else certainly has a sense of good. And if someone were to convince you that you're really, absolutely evil, how many people could really handle that? And it doesn't matter how many people, could you handle that? If you're the kind of person who couldn't handle that, then that's pretty amazing. Because good, evil, what are you talking about? The only thing that's real is this chalk and this pen and this shmata. Well, what is this good, evil stuff? Right? Show me a good, show me an evil. And here's something I can't show you, I can't even prove it exists, and yet it's more real than that which I can touch. And more critical to my life than that which I can touch. And I want to be good. And I want people to think I'm good. And it would just really blow my mind to the extent that someone might just jump out the window if they came to realization that they are purely evil. When your friend will say, well, what's purely evil? Show me the evilness on your skin. What is evil? And yet it's so real, it can have such a devastating influence on my life. Or how about the sense of my behavior must be justified? In other words, go into court, this guy's standing there. The judge looks at him and said, my friend, tell me, why did you kick that lady in the stomach? He looks at the judge, he said, I beg your pardon? Did you kick that lady's stomach? Oh, yes, I did, sir. Why did you kick that lady in the stomach? He looks at him and said, why did I? I don't understand the question. I did. I mean, I just did. The judge looks at him, what do you mean you just did? You can't just say, I just did. Why did you do that? He'll say, why did I? I don't understand the question. I did. Right, well, you know what the jury would decide. Guilty? No. Insane. Why? Why is he insane? Because a normal human being knows that there must be justification for your behavior. Right? Do animals have to justify their behavior? Do you think they have a need to justify their behavior? If I watch an ant walk in circles, and they do, you just watch this ant going back and forth, and down, or up, and up, and up, right? And I would ask this ant, excuse me, why are you doing that? Would I actually feel something's wrong with this ant if he would look at me and say, well, why shouldn't I? No, I said, well, you're an ant. You're just an ant, dumb ant. I mean, yeah, sure, that's what ants can do. They can do that. I can't do that. Because as a human being, I have a sense that there's a quality of life called justice and justification. You can't just do something out of nowhere. And if he looked at the judge and said, why did I kick the lady in the stomach? Well, because she smiled at me. I mean, she looked at me, she smiled at me, and I kicked her. Everyone would say, wow, this guy's nutso. Right? This guy's cracked out of his mind. Right? You can't kick somebody because they smiled at you. Ah, so he has a sense of justification, but it's warped. We're even sure that justification and justice is so real that there's something called warped justification. Like, that's not even good enough for us. And he says, why isn't that good enough? I mean, she smiled at me. I mean, you should see her smile, man. I mean, if she smiled at you, you'd do the same thing. No, I wouldn't do the same thing. Right? It's an amazing thing. We are aware of these qualities, these values, these principles, which are critical to human behavior. So much so that clinically the person's considered insane. Because if you don't have that kind of sensitivity and that awareness, you are not real. Something's wrong with you. Something's wrong with you because you can't show it to me, you can't prove it to me. Right? Something's wrong with you. Why is something wrong with me? Because we've already assumed these qualities are reality. Because they are realities for us. And yet how do I know this? It's called nefesh. Nefesh accesses for me an awareness of good and evil, justice, justification, and meaningful actions. Now, think about this. That has a pretty far-reaching implication in terms of ourselves and what we believe. Because if we do honestly believe in a value called good and evil, in a value called justice, in a value called meaning, well, is that compatible with then saying, I don't believe in God? Is that compatible with saying that I believe the world was simply a big bang that is reaching greater states of entropy and chaos? It's not a very consistent thing to say. Because a big bang would not be responsible for creating values like good and evil. And I certainly wouldn't feel a sense of commitment to good because the world just happened by accident millions of years ago and boom. Okay? Now again, I'm not trying to prove something. I'm trying to get us inside our own consciousness. Get inside with what we live with and what we appreciate. And let's realize what the ramifications of that really is. I'll give you an example. I had a fellow who came to a class once and told me he doesn't believe in God. I said, fine. I said, so then I guess you would feel comfortable saying that you are really intrinsically no different than a piece of dirt. He said, don't you? How could you say such a thing? So I said, well, just think this carefully. You don't believe there's a God. You don't believe the world was created within a theme and whatever. Just a big accident. So then you're just a accidental conglomeration of atoms in this form. And this piece of chalk is an accidental conglomeration of those atoms. So intrinsically, there really is no difference between you and this piece of chalk. Well, you should have seen how angry this guy got at me. And I go, what are you getting angry about? Why does that bother you so much? Because I ain't no piece of chalk. You know, I said, well, why not? Because he's got this awareness of this qualitative dimension, which isn't very scientific. And yet, is more real and more powerful in our lives than the scientific. Yeah, Peter.
But I still don't see why that necessitates a God. Just because humans can think and have self-consciousness, how does that then lead?
That's not necessitating a God. That means that you believe in a God, whether there isn't one or not. Because how could a Big Bang, right? If you believe in a Big Bang, why would you believe that there are values called good and evil and they're real values? And that you have to justify yourself when the Big Bang is no justification for reality.
But you haven't shown yet that people are not, that people aren't necessarily born with it, that it could just be social conditioning. And the reason it's, I believe in it, is just because it's just, if everyone did whatever they want, the world would just fall apart.
So let's say it's just social conditioning. I still think it, I think it's a little unrealistic, but let's just say that it's social conditioning. It doesn't matter. Because it goes hand in hand with the notion of God. So therefore, you believe in God, whether the source of it was social conditioning or not. If you're ready to let go of good and evil, then you'll be ready to let go of God. If you're not ready to let go of good and evil, so then how can you have a system of good and evil without some kind of God, without some kind of supreme being that says this is good, this is evil? How can you have a system of life is meaningful and what I'm doing meaningful, when, and on the other hand say, well, the world is a big bang and it's really going nowhere?
Because it's only meaningful, because what? Keeping society going. I don't see why.
Well, what's meaningful about keeping society going?
It's subjective in
society. But that doesn't necessarily prove that there's a God. It just means that...
No, it doesn't prove there's a God. It proves that you believe in what we call a God, whether there's a
why?
God or not.
I don't see that. How is it
because how can you have good and evil without a notion of a God?
We just created good and evil.
Yeah, but it can't exist without a God.
Why?
Right? Because you can't just say, here, we've all decided there's good and evil and we also believe in a Big Bang. Those two don't fit. They don't fit. How can there be good and evil with a Big Bang?
Why can't I just say, well, there's not absolute good and evil, there's just relative good and evil, and we just created it.
So you can say that. You can say that, well, in terms of nefesh, as far as nefesh goes, you're right, the good is really very subjective and was only a societal type of thing for self-survival. We just needed to create this value, which really isn't real because there's nothing good or evil because the world is just a big bang and is going in greater states of entropy and is about to explode anyways. So it's all meaningless. But I created this need called meaning. And I didn't just create this idea called meaning, I created a need called meaning. A need that is so intrinsic that if I'm missing it, I physically die.
Well, that
that's pretty heavy.
I assume that I'm supposed to have meaning.
What?
You haven't shown that. Never...
Why did you assume that you're supposed to have meaning in the first place? Where did you get the idea from?
Everyone, taught it to me or something.
Well, where did they get it from? Where did they get it from? The animals? The vegetables, where they come up with this idea called meaning and then successfully instigate everyone to feel that without even knowing they're feeling it and believe that without even knowing they believe it, and it becomes so intrinsic to their lives. How did we pull that off?
Well, how can you demonstrate that it is intrinsic?
Because if you draw meaning out of your life, I'm not saying it's intrinsic to everybody, I'm saying it's intrinsic in you. Because if we were to draw that out of your life, you would collapse on the spot. If you would come to a real absolute belief, without a doubt, that you are meaningless, I think Peter would jump out the window. Again, we're not trying to prove God. What we're trying to demonstrate is you already live with a notion of God, whether you know it or not. Okay?
Okay, but what if I do accept that there's an intrinsic need for meaning? How would that prove that there has to be a God?
doesn't have to be a God. Without a God, the world can't have meaning. Because without a creator, without the world being a function of will and direction and theme, how can you have meaning? Big Bang will not create a context for meaning to be meaningful or to even be possible.
But I'm just showing, oh, we're just talking about the need for meaning. We're not showing that there actually is meaning.
It doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether there is meaning or not. What matters is, in your life, there is meaning. Okay? And that's the only life you know. It's like, if how do I know this table's here? Well, you're right. I mean, it's kind of hard to prove the table's here, but I see it, you see it, we touch it, it's the world as viewed by us, and that's the only world we know, and therefore, the rest is just philosophy, gymnastics. But in my life, I experience a reality called meaning, a need for meaning, a draw for meaning, and yet to be consistent with that, I would have to say, well then, that's not very compatible with then saying I believe in a Big Bang, because a Big Bang wouldn't support that kind of a reality. So to be consistent within my own psychological makeup, right? If I believe in meaning and I have a dictionary, it has the word meaning, and that dictionary doesn't have the word God, then that dictionary can't have such a word. Right? That doesn't mean there is a God, and it doesn't mean that there is meaning. What it means is you live with a sense of meaning, and you actually live with a sense of a God. Even if you want to accept it or not, you already believe it. Okay? But you're right in terms of, it still could be relative. I mean, we could still push it off and say, well, maybe society, I don't know how society came up with meaning and then made it so important, and then made it so important that it became intrinsic to our lives. And here I am born, and I see my kid, without me saying anything, already looking for meaning in his life. And I didn't say anything to him. So then it was through the collective unconscious that you're getting pretty spiritual at that point already. But it could still be relative. In other words, good and evil could be relative, because if we all agree that it's good, then it's good. If we all agree it's bad, we'd be bad. And that's all part of social approval. And for some reason I need social approval. That itself is a little strange. Why do I need social approval? Which we'll talk about in the higher levels of consciousness, which we're reaching towards. I don't know if animals have a need for social approval. Why do human beings have such a deep need for social approval? So just hold on. Let's hold on. But it could be relative. But you can't have a notion of good and bad without some kind of supervisor that is saying, yes, this is good, this is bad, but that supervisor could be collective mankind. Right? But if there's no supervisor, no authoritative figure, then of course the notion of good and bad doesn't exist. Okay? So we have an authoritative figure, but that figure either might be a God, or I say, no, it's not. It says, look, there's this big world, and I don't know how it all happened, but basically they're authoritative. So Nefesh doesn't completely get us to total God consciousness. It gives us a sense of an authoritative figure in the universe, but that authoritative figure might be collective mankind, but it's not me, because I know that I feel guilty, even though there's something I'd like to do, but I feel I shouldn't be doing this. Okay? But it might be collective mankind, but that's why I would like to go to the next level called Ruach. In other words, Nefesh is an innate sense of a reality called good and evil and meaning in action. And on the flip side, the implicate is that there is a master, an authoritative figure. Okay? There is a judge. But granted, we might not end up with a God yet at this point. And again, none of this is trying to prove to you that therefore there is a God. But what it will show you is therefore there is a God in your life. And then what's the difference? It's all mental gymnastics after that. It's like, I might not be able to prove that there's a chair here, but I'm sitting on it, so that's my life. So why... it's just not realistic. It's like, in psychology, a person comes up to a psychologist and says, somebody is following me. So a psychologist would say, oh, you're so stupid, there's nobody following you. See, that's not the point. The point is this person is living with someone following them, and you have to deal with where they're at. And so too with yourself. I'm living with a sense of meaning, and I can't get rid of it. I don't want to get rid of it. And I can't get rid of it because it's so part of my life. And so therefore, meaning without God doesn't really work. Right? It doesn't really work. So then, to be honest with myself, I'll have to say, hey, I guess I do believe in a God. Whether there's one or not is immaterial anymore. God is already part of my life because God provides the context for these type of things called meaning and good and evil. But granted, we're not there yet. So let's go to the next level. The next level is called Ruach. Now, Ruach is connected to truth. Not good and evil. Truth. Ruach is connected to Torah. Okay? And as you can see, it's kind of reflective of what's going on here. Torah. Ruach is connected to a story that we've told before. That when you were in your mom's womb, you knew the entire Torah. You knew all the principles of life. As you were about to reveal yourself in the world and be born, perhaps deliver some phenomenal Torah discourse, this angel, practical joker, funny guy, just as I'm being born, touches me here and I forget the whole thing. Well, what is that Midrash dying to tell me? I don't have to take the Midrash literally, but it's certainly telling me something that is literally true. That Judaism believes that we are born with an innate sense of principles, truths, the way things just are, a certain suchness to reality. I have this sense that, boy, would that be terrible if I realized that I was living my whole life a lie. What are you talking about, a lie? What's a lie? What's a truth? The whole thing's a big bang. It was millions of years, you know, and then that's it. Right? Well, what do you mean? A lie, a truth, or this or that? We're just floating in space. No. I'm telling you, if it really came down to it and someone could show me that I was living a lie my whole life, it would just eat me up. Right? And you can have people say that and then they'll all say, oh, I don't believe in God. But I'm telling you, truth, right? I just gotta be truthful. Right? I gotta be truthful. There's certain principles. It's like I mentioned the story. You know, you're sitting at home, your child comes home, and says to your mom and dad, Mazel Tov, I'm engaged. I can't believe it. You didn't even introduce it to the boy. You already got engaged. Well, okay, fine. Who is it? And in comes Mr. Ed, a horse. Right? Well, you are floored. You must be joking. About what? You can't be engaged to a horse. Why can't I be engaged to a horse? Right? Because you can't be. You can't marry a horse. Well, I might be the first to do it, but I certainly can do it. Well, why shouldn't I? I mean, we get along really wonderful and got a great relationship and we never get into arguments, you know? Well, you're going to say to your kid, I'm sorry, right? You can't marry a horse. And he'll say, but Mom and Dad, I thought you were liberal. I thought you were all progressive. I thought you were open-minded. I thought you always taught me to seek my own way. You say, seek your own way. I don't care. You can't marry a horse. Well, why can't I marry a horse? Well, my friend, there are certain principles that are just the way things are and have been established and will sustain eternally to be that way. And whether it's 100 years before or 100 years later, I will never believe, and I'll never let you marry a horse. Now, Mom and Dad, you're really being unrealistic. You always told me that the world is just an expression of a big bang. Everything is just moving in greater states of entropy. And it's all just like, why can't I marry a horse? Right? And they'll say, big bang, schmig schmang, I don't care, you're not marrying a horse. Now, you're really playing a contradictory game with yourself. Because if you're the kind of person that feels that there are certain principles in the universe that you just can't transgress. I don't care, you just can't. Well, that's not very compatible with then saying, well, you know, it all just happened and there's a big thing and, you know. You're talking God talk again, and you might be the first one to say, I don't believe in a God. Well, you might say you don't believe in a God, but on the flip side of having those kind of values, you are indicating some belief in what other people call a god. Right? And you'll find people playing this game. It doesn't prove there is a god. But in your life, you're already living a life based on a god. And your kid will say, listen, if there is no god, there are no absolutes, there are no principles, and how can you expect this from me? And your parent will say, I don't care. There's no god and there are principles. You're not being consistent. You're not being consistent. And is it possible that there are values whereby the entire world might collectively agree upon and you still say no? If you're the kind of person that could entertain that possibility, well then you're the kind of person that basically believes in what we call God. If there are certain values that even in the light of a collective community accepting them, you will never do it. I mean, if you were living in Nazi Germany and the whole country has accepted that it's good, it's right, it's okay to murder the Jews, to murder the gypsies, to take people out of insane asylums and just kill them, and it makes sense, especially makes sense about the mental institutes that he went in there and destroyed. Because listen, what are these people contributing to society? Right? They're vegetables. They're nuts. They don't know anything. They're just lying in there. And just lying. They're draining our economy. The taxes that are going into paying for mental institutes throughout the world. What do we need them for? Right? We just kill them off. Well, if something inside you says, no, then that's not very compatible with a person who says, well, I believe in a Big Bang, because a Big Bang certainly is not going to endow this human being with that kind of importance, right? That kind of importance. I mean, scientifically, that human being is much less than 1/5 billionth of a speck of dust in relativity to the universe. And yet, you're sure that you can't do that, right? Now, you could say it's social conditioning, but it really doesn't matter anymore. It's your reality, right? It's your reality. And if you can't get out of it, and most probably don't even want to get out of it, then realize it's not consistent with then saying, I believe in the Big Bang, when in fact your behavior, your motives and your consciousness is indicating quite the opposite. You believe in a force which is sustaining, right? Principles that have established principles and sustaining these principles. There's certain eternal things and values that you just can't transgress. Now you're getting past the authoritative level of a society. And now you're saying, wait a second. You mean even if society says something's good, it's possible that I could entertain a situation where I'll say, I don't care, I'm not going to do it. Well, if you're that kind of person, now not every human being is that kind of person, because not every human being has successfully maintained their divine soul. Right? If you don't use it, you lose it. And there are plenty of human beings in the world that are just like animals, unfortunately. But we're not talking about that. We're not trying to present some objective proof for God. What we're trying to do is get in touch with our own subjective reality so we can be innerly consistent and just live with ourselves consistently and in harmony. And it's the greatest thing when you get yourself worked out and realize, hey, if I'm saying this, then I shouldn't be saying that. And it's only confusing myself. Yeah.
If this is the case, how can you explain the fact that people's principles and people's ideas of what is good and what is evil have changed over a relatively short period of time?
Oh no, it can change, but the very fact that we think there's a principle, that's the point. It doesn't matter what the particular principles are, but that I have a notion that there are certain principles whereby even if the world were to accept it, I could see that I might not accept that. That itself is an indication inside that you probably are not really a person who believes in a Big Bang. And even if you said you are, then you're not being consistent with your own psychology. Okay? You're not being consistent. But you're right, the values change, and you could have a society where people, you know, are marrying horses, but you won't, right? And you might even go in that society and they'll say, if you don't marry this horse, we'll kill you. You might be a person that I'd rather die than marry a horse because I just couldn't do that. Come on, where do you come up with such commitments, such convictions, and then just say that the world was an accident? It doesn't come from a world as an accident. It comes from believing that the world has been established with will, with purpose, with direction, with theme, even though you might not be orally saying that, right? But that's what you're mentally living with. And therefore, you're living an alienation of yourself by having those double standards, okay? And what's out there is out there. It doesn't matter anymore. It's my reality that I have to live with. And therefore, you know, if I see a world and I see a world, it doesn't matter if someone proves to me it's not in front of me. Okay? It's the world I'm living with. It is my world. Okay? So at this point, we have good and evil, which suggests an authoritative, judge, supervising kind of figure in the universe. And that could have been collective mankind. But now we realize that there's aspects of our own psychological, spiritual makeup which is sensitive to sustained eternal principles, which therefore indicate and implicate a divine sustainer. And what does Judaism believe in? A supervisor, a sustainer, and a creator. What we have here is, on the flip side, it's like one coin, right? On the flip side of a notion of good and evil will be an authoritative, supervising figure in the universe. Granted, we might be able to get away with saying, well, it was mankind. But it's so innate that certain things I think are good, and I don't care if all of mankind disagrees, but there's a supervisor. I go a little higher, and I recognize I'm not only conscious of good and evil, I'm conscious of something that's not even good or evil. It's not like, well, my son, it's evil to have relations with a horse. Evil? It doesn't fall. Most people wouldn't think that is evil, but it's wrong. Right? It's not evil, but it's still wrong. Well, so what's the mean? It's a principle. It's a suchness. And that's the way life is. And that's it. And no matter how, I don't care how many of your friends are marrying horses. It doesn't matter. There's principles. I don't care how many people are murdering insane people. There are principles. Now what those principles are, we might argue. But that those principles are, if you have an innate sense of them, then it's pretty haughty to then begin to think that you could then be the one to decide them. You follow? You have this innate sense that there are these eternal principles that no one, you know, should transgress, and then you think you've got the right to then decide what they are. It's a little strange. Yeah.
Well, if the principles are from a divine source and they're supposed to let people have an innate sense of what's good and bad, what's right and wrong, then how come there's a discretion in society?
Because there's something called free choice, right? God gives you a sense that there is a good. Now you have to discover and choose good. God gives you a sense that there is a truth, but now you have to deal with you making the choice to follow truth or try to work it around and say, no, this is the truth. But you still sense that there are these principles that I somehow have to grapple with. Okay, what they are, that they are, that's our lives. Most people's lives. Right? And again, we're not trying to prove that there is objectively a God, because I don't even know if there's an objective world. How could I prove there's an objective world when the world that I see and the only world I know is the one that I see with my own eyes? Right? So it's immaterial when people get into these philosophical things about the objective world when nobody knows the objective world. The only world we know is the one we see and the one we live with. And so if this is the world I live with, then in the world that I live with, there is a God-like figure. Okay? And it's not compatible to say, I have this, but I have Big Bang. It doesn't work together. Yes.
That there's principle of truth that I live with, why would it show that I also have a belief in the divine force and not the social force?
A social force, because we just create a situation where the social force is saying something else,
but
and you could still... What?
Was wrong before society changed its mind.
Well, so then, again, if you're a person that's ready to feel, I'm basically just a social conditioned animal, you feel comfortable with that, you might not believe in God. But most people don't really feel comfortable with that. It's a nice argument, but when I get down to it, I don't feel comfortable believing I'm just a socially conditioned animal where all this is really isn't any meaning, and there really isn't any values. It's just I'm being convinced to think there are, you know. But I'm still going to live with it, and I'm still going to be drawn to it, and I'm still going to seek it, and it's still essential to my happiness. I'm playing games with myself. Okay? Again, the point isn't to try and figure out philosophically how to dispute this. Because it's not this, it's you. You try to get in touch with yourself and say, what are my values? What am I really believing in? What am I truly living with? Okay? And presenting answers which are satisfying to yourself. It doesn't have to satisfy me. It has to satisfy yourself. Me. If I say to myself, well, David, you know, you're just a socially conditioned animal. For many, many years, people came up with this crazy idea called values. You're really stuck in it, and it's really unfortunate. But that's just the way you are, so what? But there isn't a God. Right? Come on. But I still, you know, now that I've convinced myself of that, I still have these values and I'm still drawn to meaning. It's still critical to me. So what's the difference? I still end up with, that's my world and I've got to live with it. And it's got to be consistent. Otherwise it breaks down and it's only painful to myself. Right? It's only painful to myself. Let's go a little further because you see the whole ladder. The next level is what's called neshama. And neshama is connected to happiness, purity. It's associated in Kabbalah with serve God with all your ma'odecha, with all your more. It's connected to a story in the Midrash that says that before the neshama comes into the world, it's taken to Gan Eden. It's taken to the Garden of Eden. And it's shown the reward of mitzvot. The reward of mitzvot. And it takes an oath that I will be a tzaddik. This is the story. Now what is that telling us about some innate sensitivity that I have? I have an innate sensitivity that available to me is an experience called being fulfilled. I have this innate sensitivity that there's some special calling that I'm in the world to do. And I want to do. And I know when I'll do it, I'll be so happy. I have this weird feeling that I'm actually very special. Not to exclusion of anybody else being very special. But I have this feeling that I'm special. That there's something unique that I can do in this world and want to do in the world. And I'm looking for that. And I'm taking all these various career tests to find out who's the real me. What am I all about? It's a very strange kind of awareness. And I can't see it and I can't touch it. I've got this weird feeling that not only can my actions be meaningful, not only can my words be meaningful, which is what I forgot about Ruach. Ruach also gives me a sense that my words have meaning. And there's certain things I just don't want to say, right? Even though, what is it, words? It's just vapors, vibrations. No. Don't say it. Because there's meaning to those words. What are you talking about? You're nuts. No, there's meaning to those words. But now, neshama tells me there's meaning to even my thoughts. I don't like you thinking about that about me. I know what you're thinking, and I don't like it. What are you talking about? Thinking, neural impulses. Why are you crazy? Thinking, you think thinking has real meaning and substance. Yeah, I do. I don't like the fact that this person said that about me. Why do you care what people say about you? In a Big Bang situation, what's the difference? They're flying off and you're flying off and it's all chaotic anyways. No, I don't want you to say that about me. And I don't want you to think that about me. Because I know that there is real personal meaning to me, the individual me. It's a very heavy psychological trip, which has no basis whatsoever. Except that's what I actually believe, and I'm drawn to believe it, and it's critical for me to believe such a thing. It's a very strange thing. In fact, the Ari says that we are so sure that there is not another individual like us in the entire universe, that if you were to meet a clone of yourself, you're guaranteed gonna hate their guts. Guaranteed you'll hate their guts. Has anybody ever come up to you and say, Jack, Jack, I hope he doesn't say it to a woman, but Jack, right? They say, Jack, you're not Jack? No, I'm not Jack. My name's David, right? You look just like Jack. Oh, yeah, I do. That's exactly how Jack talks. Oh, he does? Yeah, just like that too, right? And even the way you moved your hands right now, it's just like Jack. And even the way you were walking down the street, you sure you're not Jack? Come on, you must be Jack. It really drives you nuts. For some reason, it bothers people. Yeah, who is this person? Who could this be? The other day, someone came up to my son, my little five-year-old son, and said to his friend, hey, look, it's King David, because he has red hair. So my son looked at him and said, I'm not King David, my name is Ananiel. Can you imagine a kid 5 years old? Look at him, I'm not King David. Right. My name is Ananiel. So he said, no, because he got red hair. My son said, oh yeah? But I'm not King David. But it's really challenging to think you're somebody else. Why is it so challenging? What makes you so sure you're so special? You're so unique. And that there's this mission and there's this calling. What makes you so sure that you'll be happy? Or that at least you feel bad that you're not happy because you know you should be happy and you could be happy. Well, what does it mean to be happy? You know when a person's happy? When they're being who they were meant to be. You feel it. You feel, I was meant to be a doctor and I am a doctor. You just feel some cosmic thing saying, this is who I should have been. This is what I'm all about. That has such heavy implications in terms of believing that and living that and being that so important. It's connected to purity. Because when you walk into a store and it says 100% pure coffee, so you say, well, what is that supposed to mean? What's a pure coffee? Well, it means whatever's supposed to be in the can is exactly what's in the can. Because if it doesn't say pure, then it could be anything else. Pure means you're exactly what you're supposed to be. And you live with this sense of, what's the supposed to? Which is not compatible with the notion of Big Bang in your life. And again, it's not an objective thing. It's a subjective thing. Be honest with yourself and be honest with what you're living with. Right? If you're living with that sense of supposed to be, that sense of purpose, that sense of ideals, well, you won't find Big Bang to be a context to give those words any meaning whatsoever. Any reality, any importance. And yet they're so important. And, you know, people are living and dying for ideals. And yet those same people could say they don't believe in God, but they do, right? They do believe in God. They just don't want to say that because it has all other implications that they feel uncomfortable with, maybe. But come on, you know, you're giving your life up for something. Why would you do that? Why don't you just simply be selfish? It's like when you read some of the writings of Nietzsche, he says about himself, I am more a battlefield than a human being. Right? What's your problem? Go out, relax, get a beer. Why are you so concerned? Where did you get so much of a care and a concern for the truth and what's right and what's good and what's supposed to be? And then say you don't believe in God. You just cut the ground from beneath everything that you're working on. Right? So then why don't you just relax? If you can't relax and you really care, then it's really strange to really genuinely care in a world that's just here today, gone tomorrow, it's just all millions of years, and what's the difference? I mean, it's not compatible with then saying those kinds of things, and yet you'll find people say those kinds of things. And they care so much about making you know that that's what they think, and that's what they want to believe in, right? Because that's really important what I think. It becomes like, it's self-contradictory to care so much about showing the world that they shouldn't care, right? To care so much, to show the world, to have such an ideal, that there really is an ideal. And these were the kinds of questions that the late 19th century philosophers had. In terms of, well, now that we know there isn't a God, is there a chance for righteousness? Why would you even care for a chance for righteousness? Well, you know, because we want the world to go on. Seems a little deeper than that. So Neshama tells me that it gives me an awareness. I access something called ideals. There's good and evil. There's truth. and there are ideals, and these are all woven into the fabric of my consciousness. I'm deeply aware of them. I'm deeply drawn to them. They are very much the foundation of my life. They give me life. And yet, all those words in a dictionary doesn't have the word God. Do they really have any meaning? Am I not simply faking myself out? And if they have meaning to me, then what I might be faking myself out is when I say I don't believe in God. That might be the fake off. And what's objectively out there isn't the question. Because I don't even know an objective world. I only know my world. And the world I must live with. And the world that gives me joy. And this is what we learned, you know, in Rav Kook's article about atheism. He says, faith in God enhances human happiness. Now, a lot of people don't believe that. That's why they don't want to believe in God. Right? But faith in God enhances human happiness because a faith in God is the very foundation upon which to build a world of goodness, a world of truth, a world of ideals. And once you take God from beneath that, then what are you building all this on? You're building a palace in air. Right? And yet you want to build it. It's not like you're ready to let go of that. And you can't let go of that. And if you do let go of that, you feel like jumping out the window. What's the use of my life? So you might say it's social conditioning, but it's too late. It doesn't matter anymore. Right? It's part of your life. Okay? So it's immaterial whether it is or not. This is my reality. They might have conditioned me to think that this table's in front of me, but it doesn't matter. That's my life. That's my world. That's what I touch. And this is it. This is my world.
If you really come to a point of thinking that, you could just say, well, let me check my whole outlook on everything. But I really think
you couldn't. That's the point. You could never do it.
Maybe all these existential philosophers are only the ones who made a mistake and got so concerned about it. The ones who really were true about it, they didn't care. They didn't write anything. They just went out and had a good time with it. And they're the ones who really...
Well, maybe. The question is that you? Again, we're not trying to make... Again, don't get me wrong. We're exploring ourselves, okay? And our own psychological makeup. So we can be honest with ourselves and understand, right? Whether there is a God or not isn't the question. Whether there is a God in your life and in your behavior and in your values is really the question and the only important question that you have to ask yourself. Because everything else is just philosophical gymnastics. It's just not relevant. Right? It's not relevant. Yeah.
But I think the point is that if some people have ideals, but other people just don't seem to have any at all, it would seem to naturally imply that there is no God, because then everyone would have it, you know.
But everyone does have ideals.
But what
right?
about the people who, yeah, they just go and have a good time. They don't feel guilty, you know, or
If you probe them, that's the amazing thing. You scratch underneath the surface, you find that they'll say all these very poetic, beautiful, idealistic things that they're claiming they want to live for. They're just not. That's the problem. They are confused. They're really confused because they do have ideals and they do believe they're going to live these ideals since they're not being true to what is driving them. So you're right. But you scratch most people's surface. Again, I'm not telling you. I said very clearly there are some people who have lost their divine soul and they're really no different than animals. Okay? They're really no different than animals, unfortunately. They've lost their divine soul. They've lost consciousness of the various implicate values which indicate a relationship with God. They've lost it. Right? What? Well, they've lost that soul, so to speak, because that's what that soul enables you to have, is those consciousness. So I'm not saying you won't find people like that. But most people you meet, right, still feel their life is meaningful, still want to tell the world they're meaningful, still feel that there are certain values that they you know, these are my values. And even though they might be twisted, and even though there might be few, but even those few in their lives is pretty amazing. And they're not realizing it. They're not addressing their own inner consciousness and their own inner awarenesses, which are the foundation of their lives. That's what I perceive is going on with them.
But then why would values change over time? You know, why would, in the early history of man, you know, people used to just go kill each other, and that was it, you know? And now there's more of a belief that, you know, you just can't kill someone, you know? Why would it seem to be moving in any direction, you know?
Well, we said that there's a becoming, so that only confirms it. That the world is created in a way that there is an evolution, right, of consciousness, of God, of man, of principles. right? But it's a consciousness, and not that those principles are there are not weren't there. It's a consciousness of those principles. God created a baby and then caused you to forget it. Well, why did God do that? Well, so you have a baby who comes, so you see my kids bite each other, kick each other. You say, well, look, you see, in a short amount of time, the kid will grow up thinking there's values, right? But still, a kid at a very young age has a sense that there are principles, right? And it's an amazing thing. At a very early age, they have this sense, they have this drive for individuality and to make a statement and to have meaning and significance in this world. It's so deep, right? It's so deep. Okay, but we're not yet finished. This brings us to three levels of soul. There is the nefesh, good and evil, enables us to be aware of good and evil. And the flip side of good and evil is an awareness of some kind of supervising figure in the universe. There is ruach, which gives me a sense of truth. And the flip side of that is implicate a sustainer that sustains principles that never change. And then neshama, which on the flip side of that is a sense of creator. I've been created. Because when something's created, it's created. It means, you know, with will, with direction, with intention. Okay? I feel my existence is intentional. Right? Not just accidental. I can't relate to myself like I'm just accidental. I can't do that. And I certainly can't relate to other people's if they're just accidental. Okay? Just can't do that. I just know they're not. I just know it inside, they're not. And how I got to that knowledge doesn't matter anymore. It's there, it's my world, and that's what I live with. Next, Chaya. The next level is called Chaya. C-H-A-Y-A. Chaya. Now, this becomes more particular. Because Chaya is connected to what's called Knesset Yisrael. The collective Israel. Okay? The collective Israel. Chai is connected to Kedusha, holiness. Well, Chai is connected to a deep experience whereby I feel a strange sense of belonging to a greater reality. As much as I feel a very distinct identity, as much as I feel real meaning to myself as an individual, I don't feel that meaning is divorced from, and in fact is I experience to be derived from, a sense of belonging to some greater unit. Very deep sense. Right? And I have this strange feeling when I'm watching the news, and they talk about what happened in Greece, interesting. What happened in Paris? Wow. What happened in Israel? Israel. What happened in Israel? It's just a very deep sense. I mean, I personally always felt that I'm Jewish. And it might be social condition, it doesn't matter anymore. I experience it as real as my red hair. Right? It can't point to anything. I don't have a big nose, and some people don't even think I look Jewish. But there's this deep sense of Jew that goes beyond any social conditioning. And it's very intense. It's very intense. I have the sense of belonging to this greater soul called Am Yisrael, which is a context soul. It's not my inner identity, it's myself within a greater self. I am able to experience the possibility of self-transcendence, whereby I could imagine dying for the sake of a community. And of course, what's the community? All the particular individuals in that time-space? No, I don't sense that. I sense there is a living organism called Am Yisrael. Chai v'kayam, all the time. It's a very deep mystical experience that many people have. Right? And they're drawn to and they're devoted to. As well as, I believe, there's something very real to love. And you know, Big Bang isn't very romantic. But I don't know, I get this feeling, there's real love. Something very fulfilling and something very real. An experience of love. And in that experience of love, I may even give up my own particular life in the name of love. What is that? That deep connectedness. I was teaching a class for this anonymous Jewish youth organization. And I was doing a workshop with these, they were kids. They were 15, 16. It's not really a kid, but and we're doing it at someone's home. Well, so this time we're talking about Pesach. Freedom, human rights, and you know, it's really interesting that Jews have had always an interesting track record when it comes to devotion to human rights and leadership and human rights movements, you know. So I was trying to get them to try and understand, where does that come from? What is that all about in terms of ourselves being oppressed? So as we're going through this whole thing, this discussion, the father of the home is listening. Right? He's like watering the plants, but he wants to know, what's this rabbi indoctrinating my kid with? And you felt his presence as he tries to find every dumb thing to do, you know. Dust off the chandelier all of a sudden, just so he can be present to hear what we're talking about. But it's one thing to try and hear it, but then to react. Like, ha! And then he go on doing what he does. And I said, I don't know, Mr. Stein, why don't you join us? So, oh no, I don't even know what you're talking about. I'm just have to finish watering the rug and I'll be finished in a second. And you know, I said, well, okay, fine. And he's just wandering around us, doing all these weird things. And then I made some point, and he goes, "Pah." And I go, "Mr. Stein, please, why don't you join us?" He said, "Oh, I don't even know what you're talking about." I said, "But you don't know what we're talking about, but you certainly have a lot to say about it." So he says, "Oh, no, 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 no." Well, finally we get to this certain point about Jews and their certain consciousness and this and that. And he is not able to control himself. And I never saw anything like this. He went, "I'll tell you why Jews are like that. They're because they're there, man." And he said all these really nasty, I mean, really anti-Semitic things about Jews. Himself a Jew. His kid is sitting there, and she's pretty amazed by what it was his two kids, because they were both in this, and they were really, really amazed by what he was saying. And he just went to town. It had nothing to do with what we're saying. He says, "Spirituality's a bunch of, you know, and I'm back there feeling all this spiritual." And we're just going on and on and on. He's just like, wow, we hit a chord here that, okay. Well, he was so obnoxious and so out of place that I felt I had to nuke him. Right? I mean, I had to really get him. So I said to him, "Mr. Stein, tell me, do you love your wife?" So he says, "Well, of course I love my wife." I said, "Aha. Would you feel comfortable with anybody in any way implying that your relationship with your wife is really no different than dogs sniffing each other's rears?" This guy, you should have seen. All of a sudden he started talking about spirituality. All I said was, "No! How could you say that?" And he starts talking about, he just changed. Just like that. Starts talking about this relationship in the sense of eternity in our relationship and all that stuff. I said, "Oh, okay." Well, that's all I had to do. I just like push him in the other direction, get his other tape recorder moving, and he just came up with all this beautiful stuff, love and marriage and meaning and relationships and values and ideals and all that, when it just hit him hard, where it's his personal point. I remember I once asked this fellow, he's telling me, "I don't believe in God, and, you know, it's just Big Bang and all this, that, millions of years." So I said, "Tell me, what is the dynamics of your relationship with your wife?" He said, "Neural impulses." Can you imagine that? poor wife. I said, well, what do you love about your wife? I love her personality. I said, and so what is a personality? He said, I told you, neural impulses. You know, he must be fun to be with. Beep, beep, beep. Beep, 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 beep. Beep, 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 beep. That's it? Come on, let's be real with our experience. Okay? Because we experience that there is something very real to love and long-lasting and beautiful and important and significant and eternal. Yeah, what are you going to do with all that and then saying, and by the way, there was just a big bang and it might not have happened, but it happened too and might be here today, might be gone tomorrow, it might be, you know, and it's just, you're not being consistent. You're just not being consistent with saying one thing and then believing another thing. And, you know, drawing all these things which are critical and are really only available when you say, yes, I believe the world was created out of will and direction with theme and purpose and meaning. Right? And there are principles. And there's good and there's evil. And that's it. Without saying, no, there's no theme to life. There's no this, there's no that. Yet, love is a beautiful theme of life. Right? That I'm so drawn to. So chaya is this sense of connection. Sense that I feel that there's more to me than what's inside this physical body. And I'm prepared to self-transcend myself to be part of a reality which, again, I can't prove, I can't see, I can't hold, I can't bottle, I can't put into a mathematical equation, but it's so important. It's called love. That brings us to the highest consciousness. The highest consciousness is called Yechida. And Yechida, whereby I feel a certain identification, mystical, almost eternal identification with a nation. I can walk into a movie about Jews and feel some mystical sense of connection with the ancient Jews of the temple times. And it's a very deep sense that I have with them. Well then, Yechida tells me something else. Yechida tells me I feel a deep sense of identification with the world. With the whole world. With all of mankind. And I believe and I aspire to a day where there'll be universal love. And someday it's going to happen. And geez, if it doesn't happen, I'll be so let down. The letdown itself is an indication of how aware I am of it. Right? And how real I think it could really be. And then go ahead and say that it's all a big bang and it all just happened over millions of years and we're all evolved monkeys. It's not realistic. It's not fair to yourself. As I mentioned before, when I hold my child and I just get a sense of, wow, his breathing, his little eyes, his little forehead, a little smile. The most natural thing I have to say is, thank God. What a gift. What a creation. How meaningful this moment is to me to be able to hold my child. And I just couldn't. No matter how many books I would read, I still couldn't say, wow, what a beautifully evolved monkey. Wow. Thank you, Big Bang. I feel so gracious for this accident. It's just not consistent with my experience. It's not consistent with my inner knowledge of life. And see, that's why I don't believe in proving God. Because the God that you prove to people isn't the God they live with anyways. Right? I think it's much more important to get inside of ourselves and ask ourselves, so really, what are you living with? And no matter what kind of justifications and rationalizations that come with it, bottom line is, this kid is a gift, beautiful creation, this moment is meaningful, and it is filled with eternity. That's the experience, right? That's the experience. Not only is it the experience that people have, it's the experience that people know, that, boy, I wish I could have that, right? And being aware of it enough to say, I wish I could have that, gives so much credibility that that's very real to you. That's your reality that you live with, that you aspire to, right? And that you want to pass on to your children. So faith in God enhances human happiness, for sure, because it's the only compatible truth that completely harmonizes all the other aspects of my spiritual psychology, right? My own experience. So to prove God to people, I think there's a much more important direction. Try and go inside yourself and be honest with yourself. Hey, what really do I believe in? Because if that's really what I believe in, then why don't I start living with it? Right? And why do I pick and choose and say, well, I want that, but I don't want this? Because it doesn't work. It's going to fall apart eventually, right? Within ourselves. So any questions on what we just did? Yeah.
Where does this come from, the idea of the levels? Is it the Zohar?
Yes, all the Kabbalah. There are five levels of soul, and I just showed you that they're completely compatible with what we just said. There's the good and evil, justification, my actions must in some way be consistent with a pattern of existence. There are principles, right? There's principles. There's this feeling to myself that I am other, I am a unique identity, okay? There's this feeling that I can be idealistic, there's a certain goal, there's a certain plan to life, and there's a certain sense of love and identification. So what I just showed you, and the reason why I did this, is to show you that this whole system is inside yourself. You knew this system before you even walked in the door. Okay? It's a system we're all living with our whole life. And yet, the point is, it's in there, and it's so much part of ourselves. But how much are we investing in it for it to really blossom in our lives? That's really the question. And Judaism is not anything that alienates a person when they really understand it. Judaism gets you in touch with your own psychological makeup, your own spiritual makeup, and the things you live with and want to live with. Any other questions? Yeah.
Which levels of soul are these non-Jews?
So, to their own relativity, it seems to me that they have this also, because they obviously have a chaya, they have a nation that they connect to. There was 70 nations, okay? So, to their own relativity, they must connect. But I don't know. Any other questions? Yeah.
Under Neshama, the third part of the soul, you had said that even at a very early age, kids have a sense that they have principles and that they have these principles. Can you give an example of that?
Well, no, Neshama's ideals, ruach is principles. Kids at a very young age already know that's not fair. Really very deep. They have a sense of fair.
Isn't that taught to them by their parents? By parents saying, you know, that's not right, don't do that?
Again, it doesn't matter where it comes from. We're getting inside with, this is what we live with. But you can see, you can say that. But you can see that at an early age, they have this sense, right? They have a sense more than parents do sometimes. Okay, so there's an innate sense. But granted, first of all, the Kabbalah says that this happens over a period of time. In other words, you're born with nefesh, but ruach takes from age 0 to 13 to develop. Okay? And at age 13, it's generally understood that you have a pretty good sense, a pretty good influence from ruach. From age 13 to 18, it says, you begin to develop neshama, which is a sense of ideals and my identity. And around 18 to 20, you should have gotten your sense of neshama straight in terms of what's my purpose, what's my goals, what are my ideals. Then after 20, you begin to work on other areas. So it even has like a whole thing in terms of age when you become under the influence of this spiritual knowledge that's innate. Right?
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.